Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast and the first following our summer recess. And we're back with a bang as our first recording focuses on Europe, where some of the most disappointing news flow has been emanating. And here is our expert guest, Will James of Aberdeen Standard Investments, giving us his take on this particular subject.
Europe is a bit like the same old playlist, but you just put it on shuffle. So the same old songs come up just at different times. So what we're seeing at the moment is Italian politics coming back to the fore, the low growth environment coming back to the fore. But those things, to be honest, in the 12 or so years I've been doing this, it's always been the same, but just not necessarily in the same order at all times. I would concede that in aggregate globally, we are in a late cycle environment and Europe will feel that. But that said, if you, I think, have the resource, the capability, which we think we do have at Aberdeen Standard Investments, you can try and cut through that complexity and the noise and still identify some very, very attractive investment opportunities.
So an interesting metaphor, I'll certainly give him that. But for more colour on the macro conditions, as well as a closer look at income vesting in the region, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here, and today we're going to be looking at European equities, and on that basis we're delighted to welcome our expert guest and fund manager at Aberdeen Standard Life Investments and lead manager on their European Income Fund, Will James. Will, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Very well, Ben, thank you.
Good, good. Well, we'll see how you are after the interrogation I'm about to give you in over the course of the next 20 minutes. Now, it should be a relatively pleasant ride. Or, well, we'll see how we go, actually, because I may sort of play a bit of sort of devil's advocate at the start, wanting to know, you know, why we should consider European equities. And then as we move through the conversation, look to see where you find the most interesting opportunities within the European market, and I'll sort of test you or ask you questions on some of the more popular names. But let's begin then with European equities. I mean, sort of the data, as much as we sort of try to look for improvements, it's pretty hard to find. And so on that basis, given coupled with the sort of less than encouraging geopolitical news flow, you know, are European equities a no-go area at the moment?
I don't think so. I think the things you're maybe picking up on or pointed out there in terms of the sort of the uncertainty, the complexity of Europe, I think is fair. It's a bit like your Apple playlist, if you have Apple Music. And it's basically, Europe is a bit like the same old playlist, but you just put it on shuffle. So the same old songs come up just at different times. So what we're seeing at the moment is Italian politics coming back to the fore. What we're seeing at the moment is the low growth environment coming back to the fore. But those things, to be honest, in the 12 or so years I've been doing this, it's always been the same, but just not necessarily in the same order at all times. I would concede that I think in aggregate globally, we are in a late cycle environment and Europe will feel that. But that said, if you, I think, have the resource, the capability, which we think we do have at Aberdeen Standard Investments, you can try and cut through that complexity and the noise and still identify some very, very attractive investment opportunities, whether they be, and we're starting to see it, whether they be, you know, income, which is obviously the strategy I run and have run for the last 10 years or so. There's a very large dynamic sort of force coming around sort of ESG and values-led investment. And therefore, you know, if you're wanting that sort of stuff, then Europe is probably the go-to place because of how established the sort of corporate governance an ESG framework is, both from a top-down perspective, politicians and the like pushing for it, from an investor perspective, everybody looking for it, and a bottom-up perspective where people are having to respond to that. Income, we think, is really interesting just because actually low growth would suggest that you're going to get a much larger portion of total return from equities via the dividend and the dividend growth. Again, that's empirical evidence to suggest that's there. And you know, from a European perspective, income is really interesting because growth has been low. Growth is slow. There's not a huge amount of inflation. We've got negative yielding rates, which in some respects, the aggressiveness or the aggressiveness of the move has been surprising to us, to me. But we're there, and that's something which we're sort of used to in terms of that big yield gap versus bonds. But mature economies bring with it good, decent quality, well-established companies with strong balance sheets that are not egregiously valued. And therefore, you can get a nice 300, 350, 400 basis point carry against bonds at the moment. Feels pretty good. In terms of the quality aspect, which I'm sure you'll ask me, because we've seen that bifurcation of valuations is massive. You can find some really, really good business models out there, which you know people aren't necessarily looking for. It's not just your Nestlé's of the world. It's you know looking further down the cap scale, where there are businesses which are world leading, which are doing very, very well, have benefited from that re-rating, but on a longer term view, are looking pretty good. And then finally, around Europe, where there's obviously challenging conditions, one of the key areas we've identified lots of opportunity over the last few years is you know companies just don't stand still. You know, they actually have to change, they have to address cost bases, they have to improve profitability. And therefore, within that, there's quite a lot of opportunity. So I would say there's, you know, across those sort of four distinct areas, you know, whether it be values-based, whether it be income, whether it be, you know, quality growth, one could argue, I'm sure you'll do, or whether it be sort of change opportunities where you can try and generate some idiosyncratic alpha, I think that's pretty, you know, it's a pretty good setup, and you've got to have the resource to be able to do it. And we think, you know, certainly we think we're in a reasonably good position to be able to identify that.
Well, I did say I was sort of playing devil's advocate because we certainly don't believe that European equities are a no-go area, and you've done a very good job of articulating why you think not, or why you think European equities are a go-to place. But rather than, well, in a moment, we'll talk about how you sort of analyse businesses and where you see opportunities. But I wonder to what extent you spend sort of time looking at the broader global economic conditions and whether some of these headwinds might turn into some tailwinds. You know, we think about European growth challenges and we think about often turn to China and the idea that sort of China may be stimulating and that global growth might pick up, and that's really something that could be very helpful for European equities, or is that something that you don't want to sort of get dragged into when you're trying to manage assets?
I think we've been, I mean, in some respects, I think we've been, you know, it's a bit of a dangerous game because, you know, the market's playing this game at the moment, which is this, you know, the key issue is, you know, the uncertainty around US Sino trade. And in some respects, last year you would have been paid just to keep it simple, you know, and just say, okay, US Sino trade is going to have an impact on not necessarily growth per se, but on the investment or the sort of the willingness of CFOs, CEOs to actually make decisions to invest. And what we've seen in the last 9 months or so is that's because we haven't resolved that issue, you know, are companies holding back because they're concerned and they're worried about that. And I think that is that, you know, the more this goes on, the more likely that we're in the risk of this self-fulfilling slowdown because the lack of corporate activity from an investment perspective slows things naturally. I would argue in some areas we are probably in an industrial recession. Now, to your question, if China stimulates, how much stimulus have we seen over the last sort of 3 to 4 years, and where has it led to? It's probably kept things going and kept the wheels going. But my slight concern at this moment in time is, you know, we're trying to sort of pump prime everything yet again in terms of policy loosening. The issue with that is the more you do it, and the longer you do it, the less impact it actually has.
Yeah.
So we're probably a bit circumspect. I mean, fair enough. If China stimulates and it's good for an export-led economy like the European bloc, fantastic. We've got to be alive to those opportunities. But we're very, very, you know, we're keen to keep it as stock specific as possible, where we're looking at businesses that benefit from that, but we're also looking at businesses that are taking action around the potential that things don't do necessarily, or demand doesn't hold up as well as some people expect, and you've got to restructure. Or there are businesses out there that are in a very strong position to take market share. So we think, you know, Europe has been left out in all this. It's not as cheap as the UK. So people go, okay, fair enough. We know what the issues are in the UK. It's probably as cheap, you could argue, as emerging markets in some areas. But emerging markets always has that sort of that growth allure, you know, it's going to grow faster. And then the US, well, it's just Trump and tax and, you know, potential reflation. And they've got some leeway in terms of policy. So I think we find ourselves pretty caught in the middle of it, where the barbell is you go long GEM and long US because that sort of protects you. And then we get left out. Now, the beauty of that is the valuation opportunity is great in a number of the names, especially from an income perspective, where the market just doesn't want to care.
Forgotten asset class or ignored asset class not only creates value, but that's sort of a potential nice tailwind into the future, isn't it? If you can sort of attract
flow back in.
Yeah, that's a...
I think we can. The only problem with that, I think we have to be patient at the moment because we're sort of stuck between asset allocators who turn around and say, you know, more often than not, are UK based at this moment in time and are, you know, the B words out there and everybody's sort of worried about what that really, really means. But again, as I said, it's a bit like an Apple playlist, but on shuffle. We've sort of been here a number of times. We more often than not get through it. It's just what sort of what the cadence of that getting through it actually looks like. We feel pretty well positioned, certainly from the income perspective, you know, given the absolute yield that you're getting. I mean, if you've got clients there who aren't too worried about their capital in the short term, you know, you can get a nice 4-4.5% coupon from investing in European equities.
Well, I mean, we'll come on to how you find your stocks sort of now. I mean, when we think about income, which is obviously very important to our clients, you know, a crude split might be where you've got lots of yield on offer, but not a lot of growth from some parts of the market. And then those high quality businesses where there isn't a lot of yield on offer, but there is sort of visibility of growth into the future, you know, Nestle or something like that. I mean, to what extent, whereabouts do you fish, and where are you leaning in that regard in terms of sort of more defensive safe haven assets versus sort of valuation and higher yield?
Yeah, so I think the bifurcation of valuation has been, as you guys will know better than me, has been pretty aggressive. So you've seen, you know, the defensives with visibility benefit from what I would argue the risk-free trade. I mean, we're sitting currently with $16 trillion of negative yielding assets out there. I mean, that's a big number. The last time, you know, before the sort of Trump got elected, it was at $12 trillion. It went down a bit and it's now gone back up because people are obviously worried, where do you put your cash? When we look at that bifurcation of valuation, we sort of take a view and say, well, in some respects, you can't do much about Nestle. And I can understand why it's been doing so well. Now, we know why it's been doing so well, because actually we're sort of positively predisposed in Nestle because they've got new management in place who are actually taking action at a portfolio level. The bit that we have to also be cognizant of, but don't want to get too sucked into, is, you know, Nestle corporate bond last week, in fact, so that's some, you know, went to negative 11 basis points. Nestle dividend yield is 2.5. So if you're a Swiss investor, what are you going to do? You're probably going to go buy Nestle, and, you know, it's same cash flow. So why not buy Nestle? Now, our view is, given we want to be delivering, I'm still maybe a bit old-fashioned, but I still think 4% yield is pretty attractive, even more attractive and more than doable. We've not been willing to lower our threshold per se because we think, you know, we should be chasing risk-free type assets, you know, things that benefit from risk-free rate going down. The issue in the deep cyclical stuff or the deep value stuff, we would say we're neither growth nor value. The deep value stuff is cyclical yield. So you've got expensive defensive yield and you've got high cyclical yield. And we can, you know, you sort of back out the reasons why. One is, as we said earlier, Nestle is dependable, sustainable. You know, you buy a corporate bond on a negative yield, why not buy the divvy? On a cyclical yield perspective, and within that, I would capture banks and the deep value stuff. the market is questioning that sustainability. So again, to answer the question, where are we? We're sort of fishing somewhere in the middle. We think there's no point chasing that. We don't want to be a growth fund pretending to be an income fund. We think that's very, very dangerous. Nor do we want to be just a deep value fund. I mean, there's lots of people wanting to try and do that, and there ain't enough inflation growth really necessary at this moment in time to probably justify it. I think we could be cognizant of the risk of that rally. Where we find ourselves, and probably more so in the last sort of 6-9 months, is actually finding things in areas where we've probably been a bit circumspect on in the previous sort of 2 or 3 years. Things like specific telecom companies, where actually if we take a view and say the top line of telecom companies is challenged, what are they doing about it? Well, if you take a, whether it be a Tele2 or a Telenor, they're actually going through some fairly aggressive portfolio reorganization, focusing on the areas where they can realize value or deliver value. And with it, cash returns are going up. So you're seeing businesses with nice, high attractive yields buying back stock as well, because they see that valuation argument. Now, they're not interesting to quality growth guys, because why would you ever buy a telco company in a quality, you'd be marched out of the room if you were a quality growth guy. And if you're a deep value guy, you probably turn around and say, well, it's got no growth and the upside's not as great as I would have thought.
I'm not on to European telecoms as closely as you, clearly, but concerns about telecoms would be, the natural concern would be balance sheet. And when you say things like buying back equities, you worry that they're issuing debt to buy back shares, which doesn't do anything to alleviate those
Prices. Well, when I'm talking about telcos, the health warning is it sounds like I'm talking about the sector in aggregate. We're going to be very, very, as we are, very stock specific in the sector. So things like Vodafone, it was clear that they were going to cut their dividend 12 months ago.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, the share price, and that we buy Vodafone or we're investing in Vodafone, but just as an example, the market tends to identify these issues that you mentioned around balance sheet pretty early. As an income investor, we've got to be very, very clear and cognizant of the risk to divvies based on balance sheet analysis. So when I mentioned sort of things like Telenor or Tele2, the balance sheet's in pretty good, in pretty good state. We've got to be very, very clear on the capital structure of the business and the balance sheet in the context of that business for the, both the revenue and profit generation of that business. So those are the things where we, there's always a, we have a, there's a checklist of what are we comfortable with when it comes to investing in companies where the perceived wisdom is, and rightly so, taking Vodafone as an example, where there's not enough growth, there's too much debt, the worst place you want to be. I think some leveraged companies have been given quite a bit of a tailwind or a bit of a helping hand, given what rates are doing.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, 12 months ago, we were very concerned about balance sheets in a number of the companies, not the companies we were investing in, but generating companies. Unfortunately, it's sort of going to the point of this sort of, if there is going to be a sort of mini cyclical rally, maybe. I mean, there's obviously been a mini credit rally and therefore balance sheet rally, where if you've got 6x leverage at this moment in time, who cares? It's free money. But again, that's fine in the short term. But in the long term, we are very wary of, making a story up about a highly leveraged company just because they've been helped by a tailwind which could fade quite quickly.
Just to be clear on your sort of commitment to delivering income, I thought I sort of heard you say earlier in the conversation that you haven't had to sort of go below a threshold that you sort of target. That sort of suggests that you would have been selling the lower yielders to buy some higher yielders, and that does sort of suggest there has been some selling of defensives and buying cyclicals, or have I?
So at an aggregate level, so from portfolio perspective, the aggregate yield we target is 115% against the index, which if you just take the aggregate yield on the European market at the moment, on the Europex UK index, it's around about sort of 3.5%. So we'll look to deliver that. So we're able, by applying that, that's what we sort of hold ourselves to. I mean, there's no formal, we're not stuck by the investment association rules around having to deliver a certain level of yield. What we try and do is deliver a premium sustainable level, albeit the structure of our fund at the moment doesn't allow us necessarily to smooth income payment. We have seen some areas where we think it's the right thing to do in terms of taking some money out of some sectors that have done very well. So, for example, we've had exposure to LVMH. Now, LVMH, we've had exposure to LVMH for the last two and a half years. Now, LVMH has re-rated probably 30, 40%. We were buying it on a dividend yield of close to 3%. It's re-rated down to a dividend below 2%. For us, that feels like it's, you know, given all that's going on, it's a brilliant business, vertically integrated, good cost control. But having been able to benefit from that from a dividend growth perspective over the last 2 years, where they've grown the dividend 20-25%, we're now at a point where we feel that's sort of in the price. We're going to be pretty disciplined in terms of saying, okay, are there better opportunities out there? So we've taken that view. Now, where do we put the money? Well, we've actually, you know, we're taking, as an example, have we gone more cyclical? Well, not necessarily as a result of that. I'd say LVMH, albeit its quality, there's a cyclical element to it because of consumer demand, and we don't know whether that's going to break yet. Areas where we put it into, actually, we quite like utilities. So utilities, and bizarrely, that's versus maybe 12, 18 months ago. There's a prevailing view.
And we wouldn't have said utilities are more cyclical than LVMH.
No, they're not.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
To the point. So we're not going to cyclical value. We're identifying businesses where we see a mispricing of that dividend opportunity. And utilities is one of those areas currently, and more recently, we've seen that opportunity. And part of that is this industry and aggregating with specific names that are very well placed for what's going on from a top-down perspective in terms of, you know, we were talking about ESG, values-based investing, where there's a real pressure being brought to bear on industries to hit that sort of net zero emission target that people have put out for 2050. And you're starting to see dirty utilities, dare I say it, having to transition aggressively towards renewables with a weight of money behind it. And we think actually at the moment there are some specific examples where the valuation is like, well, it's a utility. It's neither growth nor deep cyclical. And yes, balance sheet, maybe over the balance sheet. But these companies have been forced to change by the regulatory and environmental.
And shareholders. Yourself included.
There's a push for that. I mean, we're certainly at ASI are very, very strident in our view about, you know, companies doing the right thing by investors and by the environment and by their employees, and ensuring that there's a robust governance framework for the companies that we're investing in, the environmental side and the societal side. So we think that there's something we can hopefully bring to bear, and are happy to be there for the journey. I mean, the argument in some respects you could say is you just buy all the best companies that are already there, or actually identify the companies that are in transition. And my personal view is actually identify companies that are in transition from one thing to another thing. Actually, you probably make more money for your investors than you necessarily do by just ignoring them and waiting for them to catch up. So we take sort of RWE, the German utility, as an example. That is in the midst of a very aggressive transition, which hopefully they are successful with. But they've seen the writing on the wall and they're doing something about it. And that's where, certainly from a European perspective, it's not just about having to identify, yeah, the wonderful growth opportunity that comes from selling detergent or whatever else it may be. It's actually some proper fundamental analysis to identify things where we're going to add value for, you know, our clients and the underlying unit holders and the strategies that we run.
And it's difficult to have a conversation in Europe without talking about banks. You have mentioned them sort of briefly earlier in the conversation. Just wondering how you're managing this situation. And obviously there are many different types of banks, but as a sort of a cohort, they do seem to be a bit of a hedge fund toy that sort of gets swung
wings around.
Yeah.
We took a view, and this is maybe back to sort of three, four years ago. Actually, banks we felt were, given the growth environment, which was actually sort of in recovery phase, and given the potential interest rate environment, which seemed to be stabilizing, our view, and we've got to be humble around this, was actually banks looked reasonable from an income perspective. However, around that, our view has always been, let's focus, you know, we are understanding of the industry, and we recognized a long time ago that there's overcapacity. Now, you've seen what's happened to the steel industry. In some respects, you can almost draw parallels between, you know, that overcapacity and what happens to business or industries where there is overcapacity. You know, eventually there are only a few that actually survive, if at all. Now, banks, I think, will still be around. Our view has been you've got to be focused, if you are going to own banks, the strongest capital bases, strongest business models, the ability to take market share in what is an overserved industry. So we still take a view that there are some banks that are relevant for from an income perspective that will be eventual winners. But we've got to also be very honest that the interest rate environment as it stands today, you know, overlaid against a tough growth environment, it's not a good place to be a bank. And we are very sort of, with the odd exception, pretty circumspect, certainly around core European banks, because, you know, their revenues are under pressure. And as you say, I think this is the problem. And if one was to look at the sort of Japanese experience, I'm not saying Europe is Japan. I think there's some structural differences there. But I think, you know, there appears to be very much a downward trend in sort of overall bank performance, with the risk of very aggressive rallies, but more driven by valuation and interest rate, inflation rate expectations than reality. So we do own some banks, but the banks we own are very, very well positioned to make the most out of it. Albeit at the moment, some of those, they're just getting caught up in this wave of, well, the Euribor's going down, it's probably going to go down another 20 basis points if the ECB has its way. Is that a good place to be for a bank? It certainly isn't.
Well, a good host would now do a neat summary of your positioning, but sometimes I'm not as good as I should be. I'm just sort of, because there's a relatively neutral positioning, would you say, on this defensive versus sort of cyclicality?
Yeah, I think we're probably more from a cycle perspective. I think we're pretty circumspect. You know, I've been doing this job for a while. There's a lot of things which are, yeah, I think we're definitely in late cycle. I think it'll be key to see what happens, as you say. I think the unknowns for us, and why we're probably, there's a sort of nuance and neutral position in some respects. We still think this is relatively attractive to have some cyclical exposure.
Yeah.
Because we think those companies will be winners, the companies we're backing. The way we've taken our cyclical exposure, and if one was to look at the portfolio, actually there are a number of cyclical companies, or optically cyclical companies out there, which are either making changes to their business model, but are also buying back stock. And we like the idea that they're buying back stock at the same time, which would suggest they think their companies are fundamentally undervalued. And it also stops the other actors in the market shorting, you know, what is, you know, optically cyclical, but actually are businesses that are doing pretty well. So we think there's merit to have some degree of cyclical exposure. And partly also because the one unknown that we're seeing, and we saw this last week, everybody thought the market had sort of gone into bear market territory last week. I got the sense, you know, the general sort of midsummer blues about, you know, market moves and volatility. But the market's still, you know, in a relatively good position in terms of absolute performance levels over the last sort of 6 or so months. So we're not, you know, we're going to be more volatile. And then one of the reasons is, you know, people don't know what policymakers are going to do. We don't know what that's going to mean for the real economy. The latest thing is that, you know, fiscal spend's the big thing and that how Germany's going to come out. Yeah, we're seeing, you know, last week markets were down aggressively. This week they're up aggressively. So we've got to be cognizant of what we're trying to deliver, which is at the core, nice, attractive underlying income for our unit holders. Hopefully minimize the volatility of underlying unit price by the portfolio construction that we're applying, but not going all the point to either deep value or quality growth or whatever. We're just trying to do what we've always done, which is have a broadly style agnostic portfolio, which should allow us to give a pretty reasonable and hopefully attractive through cycle total return, with income at the core of that, certainly from this portfolio's perspective. We believe we've got the resource within the European team to be able to deliver both income, but also these other outcomes which are relevant to client portfolios. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen next week? I mean, but we probably...
That was going to be my next question.
What happens next week?
No, don't worry. And of course, an increasing focus, or indeed sort of a long-standing focus on sort of the ESG outcomes as well, terms of your investment approach?
Yeah, I think we are more and more, it was always something. I mean, we've obviously gone through an interesting time in terms of the last couple of years from a merger perspective, both ourselves, Standard Life Investments and Aberdeen Asset Management. You know, both sides had clear credentials from the ESG perspective. Now we're in a position where I think we can properly, you know, and it was always something that was at the forefront of what we were doing. I just don't think we were explicit enough about it. And now it's really about properly industrializing it, to ensure that we are, you know, we are making the most of the resource that we have from an ESG perspective, both in the separate ESG team, but also within the team. And we have a dedicated ESG analyst on the team. So, you know, the fund managers, the analysts, it's part and parcel of the daily sort of discourse that we have around stocks to make sure that, you know, the things we're doing done in the best interests of the various sort of metrics that ESG is looking for, but also that we're able to still make money out of it for our clients. But it's something which, you know, I think will continue to be a very big theme and a key part of what we do, and I think allows us, we would argue, to stand out from the crowd, certainly from a asset management perspective in terms of that. We've just got to make more of it.
Okay, well, that's good to hear and reassuring, and I really appreciate your time and the very interesting and useful take you have on European markets and companies within that. So thank you, Will. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. Whatever medium you listen to us through, please give us some feedback. But until next time, many thanks for listening.